And for the very first time in my life, I was making money that I thought I should be making. And I was so driven. And God pulled the rug out from under me. The people I were working for, they saw how well I was doing, and it scared them. Because they decided that they were going to make me sign a non-compete, or they were going to fire me. In order for you to understand the book of Amos, anybody in here even read the book of Amos? Because I remember reading it a long time ago, and I thought, this doesn't make any sense. And if you don't understand something you're reading, it doesn't apply to you. But I'm here to tell you that God put the book of Amos in His Word because there's application for us today. Things that we need to know. Things that we need to be aware of. And in order to understand the book of Amos and how it fits into the Bible, I've got to give you a little bit of history. Some of the teens are saying, wait, I had history in school this week. I don't want any more history. Some of the adults say, I fell asleep in history. I don't want any more history. I don't care. You're going to have to listen anyway. So the children of Israel, they were in captivity. Moses took them out of captivity, and when he took them out of captivity, he brought them to the promised land. They got into their land. They didn't do what God said, but they're still trying to do what God says. And then they decide one day they want a king. And God says to them, you don't want a king. Do you know what a king will do to you? He's going to take your sons and your daughters, and he's going to make your daughters a part of his harem. He's going to take your sons, and he's going to take them off to war. You don't want any of this. And Israel says, oh, we want that. So they got this guy by the name of Saul. And Saul became king. And when Saul became king, things went okay for a little while. But when it comes right down to it, Saul was a loser. Saul had problems. And he got out of favor with God. And when he got out of favor with God, that's when things started to go south. So Saul becomes king, and then this young man by the name of David. And David comes along, and David was a man of passion. He had a passion for God, but he also had a passion for the ladies, evidently. Because you know the story of David and Bathsheba. I won't get into the details, but it's a really juicy story if you want to read it sometime. And they have a kid. The first kid they have together dies. And that's very upsetting to David, but they have another kid. And that kid is the one that became king. His name is Solomon. And Solomon was one of the wisest kings ever. And Solomon, in Israel's history, there has never been another king quite like Solomon. Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs. If you ever read the Proverbs in there, Solomon put all that together, compiled all that. Solomon did great things to expand the borders of Israel and to get in good with the other countries. But he also did some things that God didn't want him to do, but God still blessed Israel. And then he had a son by the name of Jeroboam. And Jeroboam became king, and when he became king, 10 of the tribes of Israel marched to Israel, to Jerusalem, to talk to him, and they said to him, look, we want to serve you, we want you to be our king, but here's what you need to know. Your father taxed us pretty heavily, and we didn't like that. And he was kind of hard on us. And so Jeroboam did what every good king should do. He went to his wise advisors. And he went to his advisors and he said to them, hey, you know, what should I do? And they said, well, you know, your dad has said, and it has been said, if you are a good and just king, people will follow you. So do what they asked, basically, is what they advised him for. Well, Jeroboam also grew up with a group of guys and teenagers. When you hang out with the wrong people, you make the wrong decisions. And so these guys that he grew up with, he went to, after he went to the wise advisors and said, what do you think I'd do? And he said to them, or they said to him, you need to tell them that if you thought my dad was bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. I have more power in my little finger than he had in his whole hand. And the 10 tribes listened to Jeroboam, and he came out and he said, I've got more power than my dad, and I'm going to show you what real power is all about. And you thought it was bad before, you just wait. And so the 10 tribes said, okay, and went away. And guess what they did? They succeeded from the union. And that's the reason why we have the northern tribe of Israel and the southern tribe of Israel. And the two that are in the north and the 10 that are in the south. And then we come to a time where there's just these different kings coming through here. And then we get to the book of Amos where Israel, the two kings, the two tribes that stayed together under Jeroboam originally are still together. And they are actually doing pretty well. Things are going pretty well for them. And one of the mistakes that they made while things were going pretty well with them is they forgot God's word and God's law. It's something I see all the time in today's society. Things are going well, and we forget the fear of the Lord. We forget that God has a law, and He has rules in place. And those rules in place, whether things are going good or things are going bad, they're still God's laws. And if we think that things are going good in our life, sometimes we will say, I don't have to obey God right now. And so Amos comes along, and Amos is from the southern kingdom. And it says that he came along, and it was 2 years before the great earthquake. Now, I don't know anything at all about that earthquake, but it must have been something that people could still remember, that earthquake. And he comes along, and he's from the southern kingdom, and he's not just any prophet. He is a prophet that is basically a fig farmer and a sheep herder. And I don't know about you, but I know in today's climate, most people don't want to listen to that kind of a preacher. He's uneducated. He's really not a full-time prophet. He hasn't been trained in the prophet schools that have been around in that day. But he comes out and he starts preaching this message. And the message that he preaches is something that gets their attention, because he starts off by doing something we all like, and that is condemning others. You see, what he does in the introduction here, it says, for three sins, even four, every single one of these places, he starts condemning. The first one he comes up to is Damascus. And Damascus, he condemns them for their military destruction. And I filled this in for you because I'm trying to get through a lot today. Amos is 9 chapters, and I'm trying to cover the first half of the book this week and the next half later on. But what he does is there, he was basically saying to them, I'm condemning you for these reasons. And he says in here, because you the thresh Gilead with sledges like from teeth. And basically what he's saying is, what your military did is after they came in and defeated these people, they destroyed it. They wiped it out. And I can remember some people in the church talking about things that were going on when we were in the Iraqi war, and they were talking about what we should do. And one of the things that I heard is that we should just nuke that place over there and turn it into glass. Well, this is what God's condemning them for doing. And then Gaza, they had military enslavement because she took the captives, whole communities, and sold them to Edom. And he's talking about the thing that is going on that God hates. And then Tyre was military enslavement and ignoring a treaty. And these are all cities that are in here and kings that are listed in here. And then Edom for killing his family and having this uncontrolled anger. And if you look throughout history, you will see kings that have killed their family, and you will see kings that have uncontrolled anger, and in their anger they have done some vicious things. And then an Ammon killing pregnant women and their babies. These are awful things. And I'm sure that the Israelites, when Amos was preaching this stuff, they were probably amening him, saying, preach on, tell us what these other people are doing wrong. And from time to time, people will come to me and they will say, you know what you need to preach on? And it's generally their pet peeve that other people are doing. So he's preaching, and he goes on, and he talks about Moab and killing a king and destroying his body. In those days and in that culture, that was the most unheard of thing ever. Even Jezebel, the worst woman in history, was given a proper burial. And one of the things that God says is, this is not something you should be doing. And then they got to Judah. And they got to Judah, and they started rejecting the law of God. That they rejected the law of God, and they had false gods. Now, he goes through all these people, and I'm sure by the time this is over or getting to this point, the people have started applauding. Because God's talking about the people that are around them. As a matter of fact, throw up that map if you don't mind. If you look at this, you see where Israel in there, and you can see all the other places that are talked about, and they're all surrounding Israel. And Amos is saying to the Israelites, this is what these people are done. Now, you need to understand something about poetry and literature of the Israelites. The number 7 was what they looked for in terms of completion. Now, when I go to a play, one of the things that I look at is I look to see how many acts it is so I can see how long I'm going to have to sit. And if it's a 2-act play, I know I've got a certain amount of sitting to do. And if it's a 3-act play, I know I've got a lot of sitting to do. But in those days when it came to literature and things like that, the number 7 was important because God created the earth in 7 days. And even in the book of Revelations, there's 7 churches that he sends. He addressed the book of Revelation to. So the number 7 was significant. So when they get to this point, they're applauding. They're thinking, this is almost over. It's like sometimes when the preacher says, in conclusion, and 20 minutes later, he keeps preaching. But a lot of you guys know that there is a time, and you can look at your sermon notes, and you can know, well, Neil's about halfway done now. We've got a long way to go. But in their minds, they were saying, you know, he's filled in all of these blanks. He's gotten to this point right now. And they were happy with his message because guess what? It was about everybody but them. And that's the thing a lot of us, when we come to church on Sunday morning, we listen to the message. And the messages we like is when it's about everybody but me. I love the people that come to me and ask me if I have a camera at their house. And I'll say, why did you ask that? And they'll say, because every Sunday you preach to me. And I say to them, no, I don't have to preach to you because every Sunday I preach to me. And you may be looking at these things and you say, well, this has to do with kings and it has to do with government. Well, I am here to tell you, as Christians, we need to be very careful who we elect. Because if we elect the wrong people and they do these things, God's going to bring judgment on us. And I think sometimes when it comes to our walk with God, we think, well, you know, God, I am doing the right thing right now. And I am following your word and I am trying so hard to obey you. But let me tell you this. There are Christians doing the same thing in countries where people are being persecuted, where people are being all kinds of bad things that are happening to them, whether they're being killed or they're being enslaved or what have you. There are Christians in those countries, and the judgment of God is on those countries. So Israel's sitting there, and they're fat. They've had all of this success. Financially, they're doing good. Things just seem to be on the up and up. And then Amos comes in and he preaches this sermon, and they're saying to themselves, I am right with God. And then all of a sudden, the gears switch and things change, and it's Israel's turn. And here's the things that he's saying against them. He is saying, letter A, you are being judged for your financial enslavement. It says, this is what the Lord says, for 3 sins of Israel, even 4, I will not relent. They sell the innocents for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. And you think to yourself, well, what does that mean? How does that work? Well, in those days, you didn't have credit cards and the things that they have today. What they had is they had a system where you could go and you could get a pair of sandals, and I would sell you a pair of sandals, and then over time you would pay me back. But what they were doing is they were telling people, you can have these sandals, but you've got to pay me back 100% more than what you have originally bargained with. And these people could not pay their debts, and when they couldn't pay their debts, what they did is they would enslave them for a pair of sandals because they couldn't pay for the shoes. So basically what he's saying here is you have been in a position of power and you are taking advantage of the poor. Several years ago, I worked as an account manager for a high-risk loan company. And I was in charge of one of their offices, and it was in Georgia. And one of the things I had to do when I went to work in Georgia is I had to go to a school in Atlanta, Georgia. And in Atlanta, Georgia, I had to learn certain things, most of which I have forgotten already. But we went to this school, and you had to pass this school in order to lend money in Georgia. And I went to the school, and I did this, and I learned everything, and I got a license to lend money in Georgia. And so I managed this office, but I came across a guy, and he was a really nice guy. He was very wealthy, and he did really well. And he said, Neil, have you looked at the laws of Georgia? And I said, sure, I've looked at the laws of Georgia. He said, you remember when you were going to class, one of the things they said that you could do, and it basically worked out, that I could make loans for $500. No more than $500, but for $500, I could make a loan. And I could charge around 30% interest. And it was legal. And in Georgia, there were a number of people that were not real well educated, that were living paycheck to paycheck, and that were basically in poverty. And this guy said to me, Neil, let's start a loan company. You can do the loans, and we will only make $500 loans. And the way that he wanted to do it is he would want to make a loan for $500 to somebody. Let them make a couple of payments. Let them get behind on their payments and then refinance the thing. And the idea behind it was within 1 year, they would be borrowing their own money back. And he was just going to collect the interest. And the idea behind it was great financially. But it was enslaving people to debt. And one of the things that I see today is that the credit card companies and the banks, and they don't come across this way, but one of the things that they do is they look for ways to enslave people through credit cards, through loans. I know I get something almost every week in the mail wanting me to refinance or wanting me to do something to put my financial future in jeopardy, and they are making their money off of the sweat of others. Second thing he condemns them for is mistreating the poor. They trample on the heads of the poor and on the dust of the ground, as on dust of the ground. And the idea here is that they just didn't care about the poor. And I'm going to confess something now. I sometimes struggle with the poor, because I've helped out a lot of the poor. And a lot of the poor are poor because of the fact that they want to be poor. They don't make the decisions that are good that will help them from being poor. I grew up in a society, in a culture that told us that you can do anything you want with your life. You can accomplish the American dream, and it's out there for everybody. And for years, I loved the verse where Jesus said, the poor you will have with you always. Because that took the monkey off of my back. And I don't think I've ever mistreated poor people, but I know one thing that I have done is I've ignored the poor. And by ignoring the poor and not helping the poor, I've mistreated the poor. Letter C, injustice for the oppressed. Injustice for the oppressed. That's one of the things that's going on today. They call it social justice, where they talk about the differences in what people get. And one of the things that's just really driving me crazy is watching some of the politicians and some of the things that are going on in the world today, and how the injustice is going on between politicians, and some of them getting something for nothing, and some of them getting a really hard time because of where they are politically. And I'm watching all of this, and I'm thinking, not only are they spending millions and millions of dollars in press and everything else for this, but the injustice of the people who do not have the proper attorneys, the injustice for those that don't have somebody that is rich in their family that can pay off or that knows people. I was in court several years ago. I was with somebody, and it was a minor infraction, but I went with them to sit with them because they were pretty nervous about it. And I was sitting there, and they were reading off the different charges of different cases, and the person who was the judge, they would read it off, and they would ask that person to stand, and we were going around the room, and they were having each person stand, and she read off this kid's name, and he stood up, and it says, "You are charged with," I believe it was smoking marijuana at a Bucks game. And I first of all thought, man, you can smoke marijuana at a Bucks game? No wonder everybody wants to go. But he was caught, and he stood up. They read the charge, and first thing he said, "Judge, I don't know if you remember me, but my mom and you are good friends, and I used to come to your house when I was little." Set that judge way back real quick, and she told him, "You need to sit down, and you will be the very last person I hear today." He was trying to use who he knew to get off of a charge. I didn't stick around to find out what happened. The final thing, or the letter D, was sexual depravity. And he's judging Israel, the country that is doing so well. He's judging them for this sexual depravity. And he says, "Father and sons use the same girl and so profane my holy name." He's basically talking about the father would have a servant girl, and he would sleep with her, and then he would pass her on to his son. And in today's world, there's some things like that that are still going on today. And of course, we can talk about the depravity that's going on with the sexual enslavement of so many people today. And then letter C, misuse of power. "They lie down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. In their house of their God, they drink wine taken as fines." And he's basically talking about people who have done things to abuse their power, taking a garment in a pledge, drinking wine that has been paid for because of fines they have imposed on people that were underneath them. Now, I'm going to just say, this is a pretty dark place, amen? This is a pretty dark place where we're at right now with the things that Israel has done. And in the next few chapters, we're going to see what God does. He preaches a couple of sermons. He does some analogies with Amos to try to explain to Amos why he's doing what he's doing. But at the very end of the book, one of the things he does is he wants to restore the Israelites. And it's point number three is this: sometimes God will destroy your present to save your future. Sometimes God will destroy your present in order to save your future. I know some of you guys know my story, how I never wanted to be a preacher, how I didn't like preachers. I had a dad that was a preacher, but that was the last thing I wanted to be, was a preacher. I went to school and studied finance because I wanted to have money. I wanted, growing up as a preacher's kid, when I was growing up, it was a very difficult life because everybody was very judgmental on the preacher. I'm so thankful for this church and the way that you've treated me and my family for almost 20 years now. I'm sure there's been some judgment, but for the most part, there's been very little judgment, and my kids were treated so well. But when I was growing up, we always got the harshest judgment as kids. And we didn't have a whole lot of money. My mom worked, my dad worked, and we were just barely able to get by. So when I was getting out of high school, the only thing I wanted to do is make money because I was tired of being broke. And I went to school to learn that, and I got into a job that I was very successful at. And when I got into this job, it was recruitment, and it was physician recruitment. It was very, very lucrative. And for the very first time in my life, I was making money that I thought I should be making. And I was so driven. And God pulled the rug out from under me. People I were working for, they saw how well I was doing, and it scared them because they decided that they were going to make me sign a non-compete or they were going to fire me. And I had just enough sense to know that that non-compete wouldn't hold water. Legally, it didn't mean a thing. I could have signed that thing all day long. But I'm going to tell you, morally, I knew that if I signed that, I would stick with it. And so I told him, I stood my ground. And I said, I'm not signing that. That's not only illegal, it's immoral. They were wanting 50% of everything I made when I left them, no matter where I went. And I wouldn't sign it. And they said, well, we're going to give you until Friday. This was on a Tuesday. We're going to give you until Friday to think about it. And I looked at them and I said, I don't need until Friday. I'm not going to sign it. And they let me go that day. And I went back to my office and I cleaned my stuff out. And I went home and I cried like a baby. And I begged God. I said, God, why did you let this happen? I said, God, I teach middle school and teen kids. That's the closest to hell on earth there is. Just kidding. If you're in middle school or you're a teen, I'm just teasing. You know I love you and I love teaching you. But I'm teaching classes. I'm involved. We're faithful. We're giving. How could this happen to me? And I realize now, years later, that God wanted to bless me in a better way. But more than just blessing me in a better way, He destroyed my present, in order to save my future. Because I would not be in front of you here today if I had not been fired from that job. I may have been a church member still. I may have been in front leading prayers and preaching from time to time, but I can tell you one thing for sure. I would not have the relationship with you and the relationship I have with God if I had stayed where I was. And I don't know where you are today spiritually, but I want you to know this. God will move things in your life in order to get your attention. And we live in a country that is so blessed, and we have so many things, and the preacher does have a good truck already. I love this kid. I want to slap him sometimes, but I love him. But we have everything we need. We have everything we need. There's not any of us in here going hungry. And if you are, we can help you. Now, we don't have everything we want, but we have everything we need. But here's the problem when you have everything you need. You forget about God. One of the most significant times in my life was when I was working with a church that was going to Honduras to build houses. And every year they would take a trip down there and they would try to find a region of Honduras that was very poor so they could go and build houses for these poor people. And my friend and a couple of other people went down there, and they were down there and they were looking at different regions of the country, and they came upon this mountain where there were very few homes but lots of people living. It was a very poor community. And they got out and they got to looking around, and all of a sudden this woman and a couple of other people came running up to them, and in Spanish she kneeled down on the ground in front of them. And of course my friend thought, well, they're wanting to make sure they get a house, because, you know, he was a white guy in a Hispanic community, so he must be a missionary. So that's his image, was she was coming and she was bowing down in front of him and asking for a house. And his interpreter looked at him and said, she's not asking for a house. She's asking for a church. And I got to go to Honduras. I didn't build a house. I got to build a church. And the very first Sunday that church was open, they didn't have enough room for all the people. We've gotten to the point in our life where we think the house is it, the truck is it, the job is it. But God wants you to know He's it. And no matter what you're going through, whether good, bad, or indifferent right now, if you don't have that relationship with God, you're lost. And you need to remember that. We sing an invitation song each week, and we sing that invitation song to encourage people to be baptized, to encourage people to change the direction they're going. If you've never, ever been buried with Christ in baptism, we've got everything ready. If you've followed Christ for a number of years, but you need to change your present to fix your future, you can do that today. If you need to do it in a public way, we can pray for you. If you've got sin in your life, you need to confess. Whatever it is, will you come as we stand and sing?